Hello and welcome to the Honest Politics Podcast. My name is Alex Gamsik and I am the founder of Honest Politics LLC. My company does political research, but not for politicians. My services are for everyday Americans just like you and me. So let's get started with today's topic, which is going to be Asian democracies tackling COVID. And before I get to that, I guess, you know, this has been a tough year, the past year, even more so than a year now. But it's nice to get out. And I'm fully vaccinated. My girlfriend's fully vaccinated. The people I know and live with are fully vaccinated. So I've been taking day trips. I've been visiting restaurants once in a while for the first time. It's just really fun. And I live in upstate New York where there's a lot of nice towns like Canandaigua, Buffalo, Syracuse, Rochester, where you can just go for a day trip. All kinds of fun things to do. Just get in your car, pull up Google Maps and find a spontaneous place to go drive. Have a nice lunch, even if it's takeout. You can walk along beaches, discover parks that you've never seen before. I was actually exercising at a kids' park earlier today, which is probably one of the most COVID workouts ever, but it was pretty fun and there was no kids around. So it would have felt weird working out next to kids, but I'm the kind of person who wakes up at 6 on Sunday and goes to the park to exercise. Anyway. Now that you're here to learn about the Asian economy and not my Sunday morning habits, so we're going to cover three countries today. We're going to cover Japan, Korea, and Taiwan and compare how their economies tackled COVID versus, you know, I did an episode last year on how democracies struggle with pandemics. So we're going to see how democracies did handling this pandemic. Let's start off first by saying this came from Investigación Económica, which is a research journal published by the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México. I probably said that wrong, but it's from the University of Mexico. It's basically the most prestigious university in all of Latin America and has like an 8% acceptance rate and is pretty famous. So this is a very prestigious school that's putting out these academic articles. So first, we're going to look at Japan. One of the things I noted was that some of the graphs were a little misleading, but these graphs were published by the government of Japan. You know, they only had 1 or 2 years on the x-axis. Their y-axis didn't start at zero. Just simple things that you have to keep in mind when reading things from governments or from anybody, honestly. But let's get into how Japan did. They did better than the United States and Europe and Brazil and India when it came to handling coronavirus. But Japan didn't do as well as other Asian countries. A little timeline here. On March 14th of 2020, there was an emergency declared. On April 7th, there was a 108 trillion yen economic measure. To convert yen to dollars, you basically divide by 100. This was about a 1 trillion US dollar economic measure that they imposed. There were not a lot of investments in the healthcare industry in this stimulus. There was not as many PCR testings in Japan as a result of a lack of federal funding. They could have put more into this bill, but anyway, Japan did well enough that in May 25th of 2020, they lifted their state of emergency. But recently, January 7th of this year, 2021, they did declare another state of emergency, mostly in the Tokyo area, because COVID cases are on the rise. As of mid-January 2021, there's 250,000 cases and 3,500 COVID deaths. You know, Japan could be doing better. Let's look at their economy and how that was affected by COVID. In October of 2019, before COVID, there was a consumption tax increase that was already putting some pressure on the Japanese economy. But with COVID, of course, there was a huge pressure on the economy, which caused a recession. From April to June of 2020 is the main drop in gross domestic product for Japan. But the stimulus did help out. There was citizen pressure to make sure everyone got a 100,000 yen stimulus check, basically $1,000 US stimulus for the people of Japan. However, there were a lot of bankruptcies. There were more bankruptcies from this COVID recession than there was in 2010 during the US housing crisis, which actually did have major impacts across the entire world, not just the United States. Half of these COVID bankruptcies were in the service industry, so like restaurants and hotels and things like that. Now, sometimes people say, like, oh, the doctors and hospitals are making tons of money off COVID. Well, listen to this, because hospitals were losing money. You know, people were delaying surgeries. They were getting rid of procedures, cancer screenings, all that kind of stuff. And hospitals had to pay higher costs to control COVID. So as a result, 90% of hospitals in Japan that were receiving COVID patients were losing income. When you look at employment, whether it's male unemployment or female unemployment, basically the people who were hit hardest by this pandemic, both in Japan and Korea and other countries, were part-time female workers. They took the biggest hit by far, females and especially part-time female workers. You know, I covered this in another podcast episode, the academic article Bonanza, about suicides in Japan are unfortunately a huge problem. And during recessions, there usually is an uptick in suicides. Both male and female suicides were on an upward trend since the start of the COVID pandemic, but it was even more so among women. And it's just a terrible thing because the bankruptcies and the loss of income was mostly affecting the service industry, and females were mostly working in the service industry. That's where the majority of the negative effects were. So, just a really tough time for Japan. And they could have done some other things to fix their COVID situation a little bit. Let's get into Korea and see what's going on with them. Korea took the position early on that they wanted to emphasize contact tracing and testing rather than social distancing. The main reason that the economy dipped for Korea was a moderate amount of distancing within Korea, and then lockdowns in other countries like America. Was horrible for Korean products because it's hard to export Korean products to countries that are shut down and people are not spending money anymore. So there was a 1.3% drop in GDP in 2020 for Korea. The biggest part of that drop was in quarter two, but the economy is coming back. Like Japan, the highest impacts were on women part-time workers. And the biggest job losses were in accommodation sectors and food sectors. Then after that, the biggest losses were in retail and wholesale. Interestingly, manufacturing jobs went down, but production went up. So with fewer people working in manufacturing, you still had more production, which unfortunately I think is a sign of those jobs will not come back because these companies have realized they don't need as many workers in manufacturing to have similar profit margins. So between 2019 and 2020 on average, Korean disposable income rose by about 4.3%, but consumption, which is basically spending, declined by 1.2%. So there's a higher household savings rate. And you saw this in America too, where there's more money in people's pockets. People aren't spending as much money to go out to restaurants or social events. People on the top, people who are wealthy enough to still have their white-collar jobs on their computers working from home, doing pretty well, saving a lot of money. And people like part-time service workers are losing everything. So we need to get to this inequality and talk more about it. Big businesses and the wealthy were doing what better while the lower income people suffered. Here's a quote from the academic article. The emergency stimulus package employed in Korea in early 2020 mainly includes liquidity provision to the firms in the nationally important industries and financial institutions. This is not entertaining for podcast material. Basically, the Korean stimulus plan targeted big businesses and helped them out more than anybody, to be honest. 86% of government stimulus spending was towards businesses rather than individuals, and most of these went to big businesses. The lowest income households did get stimulus checks, and also others got vouchers to use at local markets, which I thought was interesting. So instead of just giving everybody straight cash, they did give some people just vouchers, so they had to go and spend it. They had to stimulate the economy rather than just throwing it into a bank account. Still, spending was lower in lower income households. The author thinks this is due to lower income people using their stimulus checks on fixed costs, like rent, rather than spending it just on whatever they felt like in the economy. And the stimulus, as the author said, that was most needed did not target effectively enough. It just perpetuated the inequalities that were harming the Korean economy in the long run. So that's the thing about COVID, is it's exacerbating the inequalities that have existed in Korea for the long run. Even though Japan and Korea didn't do quite as good a job handling COVID, we're about to get to Taiwan, which somehow did really well. Learn how right after the message break. And we're back. Thank you for continuing to listen. So now we're going to look at Taiwan. And if you remember my episode from last year, Taiwan did not do a great job handling the 2003 SARS epidemic. But we're going to learn a little bit about how they handled the COVID pandemic. So first, the author emphasized a social dilemma. So the social dilemma, as described by the author, is a big reason why COVID measures failed in countries like the United States, sometimes failed in Japan and Korea, is because you have people's freedom on one hand and then public benefit on another. And the social dilemma happens when restricting people's freedom creates public benefits, but people don't want restrictions to their freedom. They don't want to wear masks. They don't want to social distance. So, you know, how do you impose social benefits that create restrictions to personal freedom? People will not do this of their own free will a lot of the time. So government intervention is needed, but government intervention only works so much as people are willing to tolerate it. People are not going to wear masks in their own homes, and the government can't just break into everyone's home and tell them to wear a mask. You need cooperation. So there's certain conditions you need to get this to work, like asking people to stay home even though they want to shop or go out to grocery stores. Even in countries with good leadership, trust, and civil participation, they fail to solve the social dilemma. Well, in Taiwan with COVID, there were only 937 cases as of February 2021. So less than 1,000 cases in a country with 23 million people. 9 deaths, unfortunately, but still that's a much lower death rate than other places. And their GDP growth was 3%. Which is tied with their GDP growth in 2019. And guess what? They did not have strict lockdowns. So they did really well. Their economy's booming. They didn't have that much death and destruction from COVID. And they didn't have strict lockdowns. So how did this happen in Taiwan, especially when they failed mostly in 2003? Well, the author acknowledges that a lot of people on social media and everywhere are saying the Oriental culture of togetherness a lot of people thought was the reason. Like, Asian cultures are more understanding that they are a part of a whole. It's not as much the rugged individualism that you get in America, per se. It's more like, we understand that we are together, we're a team, we're all Nihonjin, we're all Japanese, or whatever else. So, but the author's like, that doesn't really explain it. They were saying there were other reasons that Taiwan did well besides that. In fact, they learned lessons from the 2003 SARS epidemic, and they had a plan. They had pre-agreed agreements with the government, the market, and civil society. There was cooperation following the outbreak in China, traced partly to their democratization and industrialized society, and they had early recognition of the threat and quick action due to their exclusion from the WHO. There was pressure from China, so they didn't have an opportunity to free ride, and there wasn't much uncertainty. Basically, Taiwan had, they knew they were in it for themselves. They knew China wasn't going to help them. They knew the international world wasn't going to help them. So they just went for it. But they booked it and took care of COVID. The literature basically, you know, now we're getting into why the economy slows down because of COVID. The research shows that voluntarily staying at home is why the economy takes a big hit. So if you make people less scared of COVID, the economy will do better. How do you make people less scared? Probably by controlling the disease. I mean, that seems, you know, reducing the death rate improves the economy is what statisticians have been finding. So the best way to get the economy going is to control the pandemic. In places like America, that didn't really happen. You saw 55 million Americans traveling for Thanksgiving, despite the guidelines saying not to, which was almost 3% higher travel rates than the previous year. And then looking kind of at why Taiwan didn't do mass testing. And you might be wondering, how did they control the pandemic without doing mass testing? Well, it doesn't work well when asymptomatic people are the ones spreading the disease, because most asymptomatic people are not just randomly going to walk in to get a test. mass testing is more of a mitigation tool than a completely containing the disease thing. Mass testing is bad when there's just a few cases because it's inefficient use of resources, and mass testing creates false positives. And when there's only a few cases in the population, you get really confused really easily with those false positives, even if there's just a few of them. So Taiwan disregarded this when there were just a few cases. But mass testing is also a problem when there's, because it creates more false negatives the more mass testing you do. That's not good either. And contact tracing is actually useless when there's widespread spread because there's too many interactions. You can't trace millions of people going to millions of other people. It's so difficult for the government to call up every single person and write an entire case summary on them. Contact tracing and testing are best when they're targeted. And that's what Taiwan, they targeted the testing and the contact tracing. So it was efficient and successful. And we're going to get to why that approach worked in just a little bit. So Taiwan started prepping for COVID on December 31, 2019. So before 2020 even started, Taiwan was getting ready, 3 weeks before their first case. What they did was a combination of a border quarantine, target-based measures like testing and contact tracing, and then population measures like masking and social distancing. Little bit of a timeline, they made a 4-hour test kit on January 12th, so pretty easily, pretty early they had testing kits for COVID. Starting on January 23rd, all travelers had a strict 14-day quarantine when they came from Wuhan, and then everyone coming internationally had a quarantine starting March 19th. So March 19th, everyone coming into the country had a very strict 14-day quarantine. And if you broke this quarantine, you faced a $33,000 fine. So you don't want to pay $33,000. You're going to stay in your hotel room. And it's actually kind of cool. I remember seeing a YouTube series by this guy who traveled to Australia and had to do a government-mandated quarantine where they actually put you up into a hotel room, but you couldn't leave. So, you know, he was on his computer and they put food outside his door and everything. But some of these countries had very strict measures like Taiwan that basically kept COVID at bay. It didn't allow it into the country. People in Taiwan were tracked by their cell phone to make sure they were in quarantine. They had checkup calls 2 or 3 times a day to see how they were doing, check on any symptoms. And if there were any abnormalities, the police would go to their room. But citizens of Taiwan they got compensation. They got cash money for staying in quarantine and for obeying the government's orders. They did a lot of targeted testing and contact tracing, like I said. The targeted approach only worked because of the strict border. So I was saying the mass testing was kind of useless, but because they had a strict, you can't come into this country unless you stay inside for 14 days policy, there were fewer cases, so it was much easier to target your testing. It was much easier to target your contact tracing, and you're tracking everyone by their cell phones too. This wasn't mentioned in the article, but I think them being an island also really helped because it was much easier to control who came in and out of the country. Take America, for example. There's hundreds of thousands of people coming into the country, overstaying their visas or whatever. Our border is more porous because there's a huge tract of land. But when you're an island, you're surrounded by a giant ocean. It's a little harder to just sneak on in. So I think, would this kind of thing work for America? Not really. It could have worked for Japan. Japan's an island nation. Lots of islands, but still. Korea, you know, it's not like, unless there's North Koreans pouring over the border there, it's mostly an island. It's a peninsula, okay? And North Korea is on the other side, and that's a very heavily guarded border. So, I mean, Korea and Japan could have done this very strict border is what I'm trying to say. Whereas other countries like in Europe or America probably would have been tougher to completely close down your border in this fashion. But anyway, I'm getting to the next point, which is that after the failures with SARS, Taiwan reconstructed their command and medical systems. First off, they centralized decision-making within the government, and they reduced red tape in issuing public health orders. Medically, Taiwan redefined balance between individual rights and public obligations. They strengthened the government's ability to restrict individual personal freedoms. Instead of having little local governments making all different kinds of rules and regulations that conflict with each other, Taiwan's central government just made all of the decisions, and had a stronger hand in forcing it on people, which sounds less democratic, and it is, but considering their economy did much better, their, you know, death and COVID rates were much lower, you got to think to yourself, in what instances is something a little more authoritative like this useful during emergencies, I would wager, versus having the slow, deliberative process of democracy in other areas? They also set up a network of mostly public hospitals and first responder units. They did regular exercises like practice to establish trust and cooperation. They also hired multiple disease control experts. They did all of this before COVID, I should have said. All of these like prepping measures. When COVID was starting, China in 2020 stopped exporting masks to the rest of the world. You know, they previously had been making half of the world's masks. And then when COVID started, they kept all of it for themselves. So Taiwan could not possibly produce enough masks on their own. They needed the government to help ramp up production. So Taiwan went from making 1.8 million masks per day originally to 20 million masks per day by May of 2020. And there's only 23 million people in the population, so they're basically making as many masks per day as there were people in the entire population by May of 2020. Rather than seizing the production lines, like, you know, there was a lot of people complaining in the United States, oh, why didn't Trump use more of the Defense Production Act? But even in Taiwan, which ramped up production successfully, they did not have the government take over private businesses. They did have incentives that, you know, were kind of complicated, but basically they ensured you're going to make a profit off of this, companies. There's very little risk because the government is going to take care of you. You're not going to lose money by making a ton of face masks. And then when demand drops off, we're not just going to leave you hanging. We're going to make sure that you still have a profit and this is a worthwhile venture. And, you know, once people see a profitable, worthwhile venture, they'll start making masks like crazy. So that's basically what happened in Taiwan. You need the government to help out. You don't necessarily need the government to take over. Taiwan reacted quickly to this virus, like I said before, way before, you know, China really took measures to address it. There were, you know, leaks from doctors in China who were telling or warning the world about this. Taiwan discovered it very quickly, even though China was trying to censor and stop it, which, you know, they did, but Taiwan was smart enough to get this information and act on it before 2020 even started. And the World Health Organization is pressured by China because China is a major contributor to the World Health Organization. The World Health Organization does not recognize Taiwan as a country. And during the SARS epidemic, this really hurt. But Taiwan knew now that they could not rely on international organizations to make their way through this pandemic. They took it upon themselves. They didn't free ride. They didn't wait. They were not uncertain. They just went for it. And Taiwan took control of the situation. We see that they're a success story compared to countries like Korea and Japan. And all three of these nations are success stories compared to places like Europe, the United States, Brazil, India now with the horrible ravaging virus. It's just a horrible situation, this entire pandemic. But you can see how democracies can make it through these pandemics. And it's not just the Asian culture that gets them this way. It's, you know, the measures they took. I think being island nations helped them as well. It's easier to control, you know, like New Zealand and Australia did well as well, because it's harder to restrict immigration from America or from Europe, where they're bordering many other countries. But anyway, now that the vaccines are rolling out, at least in the United States, then later this year, we can start exporting them to other countries that need them. I think the pandemic is going to be behind us. I don't think we're going to reach herd immunity. There's too many anti-vaxxers out there. But we're going to have much less of COVID in the economy, in the country. We're going to have it at such a low level that hospitals can tolerate it. And we'll be going to Bills games in the near future. I'm excited for that. And I'm excited to live out my best life this summer. Because one thing that even though I'm taking a accounting degree online, I'm working hard to take care of my household duties. I'm working hard at my full-time job. But rather than just working, 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 you also have to enjoy what you have. I'm going to do that this summer. really going to have some fun outside in the sun, and I hope you all have a great day. Next time on this podcast, I hope to have an interview or more academic articles. I'm going to release episodes on the 4th of every month, and then just occasionally, who knows, maybe just random episodes here and there. So thank you so much. Thanks for tuning into the Honest Politics Podcast, and I'll see you next time as we seek to discover more of the stories behind the statistics. So I'm really glad you tuned in, and I love you. I mean, and we'll come back next time on this podcast.